I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, the agency that handles green cards, citizenship applications, and DACA renewals, recently made headlines when its new director made a change to the agency's mission statement. The controversy centered around the decision to remove a reference to the United States as a, quote, nation of immigrants. There was also controversy over the decision to no longer refer to applicants as customers. In a memo to USCIS staff, Director L. Francis Cisna says referring to applicants as customers implies the agency is serving them, not the American people. Former USCIS Director Leon Rodriguez, who led the agency from 2014 to 2017, responded to this with an article in the Washington Post, writing that the new mission statement articulates the Trump administration's policies that portray immigrants as a threat and burden to the nation. A statement from USCIS Director Cisna reads that the new mission statement reflects his guiding principles for the agency, which focuses on, quote, fairness, lawfulness, and efficiency, protecting American workers and safeguarding the homeland, end quote. Cisna adds that the new mission statement reflects the core responsibilities of the agency, quote, which is to serve the interest of the American public by overseeing and ensuring the integrity of the immigration system and safeguarding the homeland, end quote. To view the previous and new mission statements, go to tpr.org. The subject of immigration is a complex one, and with each administration comes changes in policy and enforcement. San Antonio attorney Frank Menchaca is a federal practitioner. He says immigration law has evolved over the years, but the most significant changes came after the attacks of September 11th, 2001.
Well, primarily what you're dealing with is because of the attacks of 9/11. The government felt, and rightfully so, that immigration law needed to have some more teeth attached to it. So what ended up happening is the administrative law that immigration falls under, as administrative law, they do not actually apply criminal law statutes. Instead, immigration law is applied, and they're specifically applied in immigration courts. In other words, in immigration courts, they cannot hear criminal law cases. And in criminal law courts, they cannot hear administrative or immigration type cases.
Let's just sort of go into what's the difference maybe between a criminal violation and an administrative violation. What are some examples of each?
Okay. Everybody is familiar with criminal law, such as a misdemeanor versus a felony. And you have essentially a hierarchy. People know the felony is worse than a misdemeanor. And in misdemeanor cases, just like felonies, the classification is busted up into, for example, the low end, a traffic ticket, which is considered a Class C. Now, when you look at immigration law, on the other hand, there is no violation of criminal law. The method of handling any type of hearing regarding an administrative law violation when it comes to immigration is through the immigration courts. So you have an immigration judge who hears the case, and they are responsible for either the removal of the individual who's undocumented, or they allow them to stay pending, say, appeal or what have you. They may place them on bond. Because the immigration courts cannot file criminal law violations against these individuals, initially, these cases are not a criminal law violation. They are an administrative law violation, an immigration law violation. Once you have an immigration law violation, then those people are deportable. Now, for me, as a federal practitioner, I will not see these cases until the individual has been deported and they come back. without having their papers in order. When they do not have their papers in order, then that is a violation of our federal criminal statutes. So at that point, it becomes a criminal law violation. As a federal practitioner that handles these cases, when that occurs, I then represent these individuals, and these are considered federal felonies. So it is not until these individuals reenter without proper documentation that it becomes technically illegal.
So essentially you're saying that an immigrant, when they first come into the country with no papers, with no documentation, they are not technically illegal, but that's still the terminology that we use for these people who are crossing. However, they don't technically become, quote unquote, illegal until the second time they try to cross undocumented, correct?
Yes, that is correct. The better term is undocumented immigrant because they don't have papers. And so if you don't have the proper paperwork, you end up in immigration court because you have to go through the administrative process of being removed from the country. And that is why the individuals never see a criminal court unless they violate a criminal law statute or unless they reenter again. And that is what's called illegal reentry. Once we go ahead and do the federal prosecution of that case, then at that point, they are then deported again. And this is where there's confusion that arises because people don't understand, for the most part, that the first time they come in, it is not a criminal law violation. It's important to make that distinction. Technically speaking, an administrative violation being less than criminal law violation is essentially less than a traffic ticket. And this is hard to understand because it's very confusing to see that everybody continues using the term of illegal. And so after 9-1-1, you see more of an evolution of the administrative law, the immigration law. So with more teeth, it becomes more criminal law in application by the judges. If you only apply the rule of law as to what your agenda is, you take away the balancing components that allow us to understand the true nature of the violation. Without respect for hierarchy of law and without respect to the Constitution, which supersedes all law, you end up with this unbalanced state that we're in and this confusion that is understandably out there. We are playing language games.
So immigrants who come into the U.S. Undocumented or the second time around illegally, there's a process that they go through. Like you were saying, they can go through the immigration courts. I understand there's something called expedited removal. What exactly goes into that process?
Okay. Once again, it have to differentiate between the two areas of law because the expedited removals, once again, all handled through immigration courts because these are administrative proceedings. They go ahead and have the individual that's undocumented sign an agreement that they're not going to fight their deportation. So therefore, they can be removed more quickly and potentially without the penalty of having federal criminal charges filed against you.
I understand that when immigrants are caught by the Border Patrol, many of them, if not all of them, are made to sign a voluntary removal form. Is that correct?
They are encouraged to go ahead and sign that, yes. Unfortunately, voluntary removal, while in the past, meant that when you came back in, for all practical purposes, you weren't going to be prosecuted under the federal statutes of illegal reentry. And so you basically got another shot at it because you weren't fighting it, like, okay, yes, you got me. And then you try again. Well, now one of the changes is even though you signed voluntary removal, it doesn't mean as much. And if you don't fight against your removal, you're going to be in the same position as someone who did and got deported. And the fact is, if you don't fight it, you never have a shot. You may have administrative remedies available to you. And by not knowing your rights because you don't have counsel, it's oftentimes seems easier just to sign off on it because you're not told that, oh, by the way, chances when you come back again is that you're actually going to be charged with the federal crime of illegal reentry.
That's San Antonio attorney Frank Menchaca. In another example of the evolution of immigration law, the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled that immigrants, both legal and undocumented, are not entitled to bail hearings. The cases involve asylees who have passed the first level of screening and legal permanent residents who have committed a relatively minor crime. They become subject to potential deportation. The High Court sent the case back to the lower court with two unresolved questions: whether indefinite detention without bail is unconstitutional, and whether a challenge to no bail can be brought as a class action instead of an individual case. Coming up next on Fronteras, improvements in medical care often result in less illnesses and death.
The reduction of maternal mortality is one of the great successes of public health in the 20th century.
But that's not the case in Texas. We'll explore the first in a three-part series on maternal mortality rates in Texas when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. There's an alarming number of women dying while pregnant or shortly after giving birth in Texas. Last year, Texas lawmakers directed a task force investigating maternal deaths to come up with ways to curb those deaths in the future. Today, we begin a three-part series looking at how they might do that. As KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, it might in part mean looking at how other states made motherhood safer.
Good morning. I'd like to call our meeting to order.
This is Lisa Ollier. She's the chair of a task force that's investigating what's happening to mothers in Texas, specifically why so many of them are dying while pregnant, while giving birth, or shortly after having a baby.
If we could all take just a moment of silence to remember the Texas families who are forever impacted by the loss of a mother.
This meeting happened last fall. It was basically an update on what this team of researchers and medical professionals have found so far. They've been at this for years at this point. So they went over their findings, and then they opened up the meeting for public comment.
Good morning. Ted Fox from San Antonio, Texas. I thank you for this opportunity to offer comments.
Ted Fox is a retired hospital CEO. For decades, he'd go to small rural hospitals in Louisiana and near the border in California. Fox would turn those hospitals around so they could better serve vulnerable populations. During this meeting in Austin in September, he told members of the task force he's discouraged by the recommendations they've been making. He says they're too soft. Fox says more needs to be done to save lives in Texas. And then he says, you guys need to look at California.
California reduced its maternal mortality rate more than half, from 14.0 to 6.2, a fraction of Texas, in 4 years. There are some lessons we can learn.
Well, I went to California, and I found out what some of those lessons are. I spoke to doctors, folks at nonprofits who helped fund some of the things that stopped women from dying. But first, let's start with some history.
In 2006, the Department of Public Health noted that the maternal mortality rate in California was starting to rise.
That's Elliot Main. He's
the director of the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative based at Stanford University.
Anyway, maternal mortality was ticking up, and that took a lot of people by surprise because maternal mortality is something that a lot of public health officials thought was pretty much solved.
The reduction of maternal mortality is one of the great successes of public health in the 20th century.
Maternal deaths became very rare by the 1940s because of something called maternal mortality review committees. These committees combed through data and came up with advice on how to stop other women from dying. And these committees were really effective.
So much so that most states closed all their maternal mortality review committees, thinking that this problem was solved.
Cut to some decades later in California, and public health officials started to notice that rate going up.
The Department of Health noted the rise and then engaged a group of physicians, nurses, and social scientists to start examining the actual causes of the rise and what could be done.
I met Elliot Main, by the way, at a hospital in San Francisco. He now leads a collaborative, which is known as the CMQCC. He's the brains behind most of the initiatives that cut the state's maternal mortality rate in half in just a few short years. I can't stress enough how important Main is to the story of what California did. And here's some of his advice on how other states can do what California did. Lesson number one, acknowledge there's a problem and find smart people to fix it.
The first thing we ask a state to do is to form a collaborative of your leading physicians, your health department, and your hospital association. Those are three critical elements to making change.
In healthcare, people talk a lot about the problem of silos. The idea is that too often folks in different fields don't get to share their expertise and help each other. Collaboratives address that problem. And Maine says maternal mortality review committees like the ones from the 1940s can focus on collecting data. Lesson number two, get good data.
The best way to capture the cases is to link birth certificates to death certificates.
Main says that way, if a woman dies within a year of that birth certificate being filed, the death can be flagged for review. Main says if you don't have a clear picture of what the problem is, you can't make a good plan for fixing it. Now, lesson number three. Use your data to figure out what problems you're going to solve. And in this case, Main says their research found that women were dying in high numbers from heart disease, complications from hypertension, and hemorrhage.
So this led us to say that there were things that we could do to reduce the rate pretty quickly. In turn, that led to the development of quality improvement toolkits.
Okay, I'm going to stop right here and explain what quality improvement toolkits are. They might sound really boring, but they are really important when it comes to saving the life of a woman in labor. So stay with me. All you need to know is that these toolkits are like very detailed emergency plans. It's usually hundreds of pages full of advice on what to do if something goes wrong. It also has a checklist of everything a delivery ward should have readily available. And Maine and others made the toolkits available to everyone, and I mean anyone with access to the internet. And that includes this doctor who has a stack of them on her desk.
This is the one about hemorrhage. Mm. And then there's one about preeclampsia.
Right.
And they're all very good. Let me just see if it's right here. It's very good. This is all you need.
That's Katerina
Lanier-Cousin. And I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. And I am presently the administrative medical director for Alta Bates Summit Medical Center for Women's Services.
Alta Bates is in Berkeley, California. It's on the East Bay, just across the water from where I met Elliot Main. Lanier-Cousin says the toolkits have become a staple in her delivery ward.
So this is the toolkit to support vaginal birth and reduce the primary cesarean section.
C-sections tend to lead to more health complications than natural births. She says everyone on her team, from nurses to midwives to surgeons, reads these toolkits. That way, she says, everyone is literally on the same page.
So you have a map that you could use to implement this at your own site, which makes it very useful.
Lesson number four. You need the medical community, people like Lanier-Cousin, to buy into the solutions.
When you enter a system and you're interested in changing patterns of care, that's you.
She says getting doctors to buy in means giving them evidence and data that these toolkits work. And in Lanier-Cousin's case, she's seeing results. For example, remember that toolkit aimed at preventing C-sections?
I was just looking at it. Our cesarean section rate for first-time moms in labor is usually around 20%. Which is a very low rate.
Lesson number five, and this is the last one, accountability. In California right now, anyone can find out a hospital C-section rate or its elective delivery rates, among other things. This info is so public, it shows up on a hospital's Yelp page. Stephanie Telicki is with the California Healthcare Foundation. Her group funded the public database that provides all that information to anyone who wants it. She says the database lets anyone drill down and even see an individual doctor's performance.
It helps pinpoint the drivers of whatever they're looking at. So it tries to help the hospital have a dashboard to look at, this is how I'm doing, this is how I'm doing compared to other hospitals in the state.
Telicki says after years of work and more hospitals in California contributing data, C-section rates have dropped precipitously, and maternal deaths in California have dropped right along with them. The maternal death rate there is now about 7 for every 100,000 births. That's the kind of rate you see in Western Europe. In Texas, the rate is 5 times that, on par with countries like Uzbekistan. Telicki says other states can replicate what California has accomplished.
While it's not an easy lift always, it is a very feasible lift. And I just would submit that if California was able to do it, that other large and small states can make this possible.
She says Texas has no excuses. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Next week, Ashley looks at how the lessons from California's experience can be applied in Texas and how some healthcare providers are already trying. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.